you pay attention and there's more to it.
Absolutely. And that's something that I've been learning so much just in the last 3 years working with John. You know, my background is in science, and I know my academic background taught me a lot about how to do science and how evolution works and that kind of stuff. But my education with John has been to go outside and recognize what I'm seeing, which has been a very steep learning curve. But as soon as you start looking, you realize how much is out there. Even trees, you know, I was looking at a forest and see a bunch of maples, and I was like, okay, there are probably, you know, 10 species of trees in this forest. Not even close.
No.
And I've had that experience with dragonflies too. You know, I try to learn a couple and then I realize that there are, you know, 40 species. And it's just delightful that there's just all this diversity and every single species has something cool about it. Yeah, I've really enjoyed getting like a very broad, shallow view of what's going on around me. Yeah, they saw their last hummingbird at their feeder September 19th. We've had to take our hummingbird feeder down because of the bears. But that's exciting that they got to see that and that they noticed it was their last. Skunk digging holes in the yard. We sadly have not seen many skunks in our area since I've been an adult. I remember skunks being a problem for our dogs when I was growing up, but I haven't seen one in a long time. I see them sometimes hit by roadkill or hit by cars on the road, but I love a skunk. I know that they're, you know, stinky, etc., but there's something so charming about them and the way that they stomp to like scare off predators before they spray. And I just love a weasel. So makes me happy that they're, you know, seeing skunks as long as no one gets sprayed.
As you do. Well, Charlie, you are going to be sitting in for John Latimer coming up for our phrenology report. And then you're going to be back with us next hour. We've got more student phrenology to report, and you can give us some notes on that. And thank you so much. We'll check in a little bit.
Great. Thanks, Heidi.
Thanks. This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Thanks to you for listening this morning, and thanks to business supporters like Clocko Brewing in Grand Rapids, making traditional old-world styles of beer and modern classics for 7 years. Their tap room is open Monday through Saturday, noon to 8, Sunday from noon to 6. More info at clockobrewing.com. Local news is next.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. The Virginia Fire Department rescued two men after their falls down a 100-foot cliff Saturday. In a news release, the fire department says they responded to the Mesabi Bike Trail access in Virginia around 4:30 that afternoon and heard two men calling for help from a mine pit. One man was about 50 feet down clinging to a cliff, and the other was about 100 feet down at the water's edge with reported injuries. Rescuers rappelled down the cliffside to reach the two men, with the first able to climb out with assistance. The second man was evacuated from the mine pit via boat and transported to Essentia Health Virginia for treatment of minor injuries. Multiple Minnesota outlets are reporting more possible fraud within the state's Department of Human Services. In a letter to state lawmakers, WCCO and the STRIB report that temporary DHS Commissioner Shireen Gandhi described stopping payments to 11 disability service providers earlier in September. The stop payments also impacted an additional 17 providers affiliated with the Integrated Community Supports Program. This is a Medicaid service that provides training and help to adults with disabilities who live in a provider-controlled setting, such as providing opportunities for community participation, health, safety, and wellness, household management, or adaptive skills. Gandhi described the program as filling the gap between a person living in their own home and more restrictive settings, such as a group home or assisted living. The fraud allegations accuse these providers of billing the state for services that were not provided. The move to suspend payments comes amid a backdrop of numerous federal investigations into the department, recently with suspected fraud within the Housing Stabilization Services Program, as well as the massive and still unfolding Feeding Our Future scandal. Northern Township is presenting its case to become a city this week during the first days of a two-week administrative trial. Northern Township is seeking to firm up its boundary against any further annexation by its nearest neighbor, the City of Bemidji. It plans to construct a new multi-million dollar wastewater treatment facility, securing nearly half of the cost with federal grant dollars and covering the rest with additional assessments on the property taxes of connected households. The township is also pursuing additional funds to cover the infrastructure through state bonding dollars, having been included on a 2023 bonding bill that never made it to the finish line. Next week, Bemidji will present its case to annex around Lake Bemidji. The city says it can get sewer and water around the lake connected to its already established systems at a lower connection cost to its ratepayers. The trial in Northern Township will take place all day Monday through Friday at its town hall, with a public hearing scheduled for 6 p.m. Tuesday at the Beltrami County Fairgrounds 4-H building. The trial in Bemidji will also be multiple days at City Hall next week, with a public hearing slated for 6 p.m. Wednesday, October 8th at the Sanford Event Center. State and federal agencies are working on a joint effort in the Chippewa National Forest to slow down the spread of emerald ash borer. The effort throughout September has involved the release of three species of non-stinging wasps to target the invasive borer at different life stages. The wasps are small and do not harm humans, and the USDA says it has tested to ensure the wasps won't impact other species in the forest. More than 5,000 were released into 200 acres of infested areas of the Chippewa National Forest this year, with nearly 4,000 released last summer. The state's Ag Department began releasing these types of wasps in 2010 to slow the spread of emerald ash borer, with the wasps released into 55 infested sites since. EAB was first detected in Minnesota in 2009 and is a growing concern to forest health experts, as Minnesota is home to an estimated 1 billion ash trees. Resurfacing of Highway 64 between Akeley and LaPorte began Monday. MnDOT says construction crews will resurface the highway using a micro-mill and thin-lay process, which will provide a smoother ride for drivers. Work is expected to be complete mid-October, weather permitting. Motorists can expect flagger and pilot car operations. That's it for the Up North Report. Find more of our stories at KAXE.org, where you can also find content from our music, morning show, and Phenology teams. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
It is the Tuesday morning show on People Powered KAXE. Coming up, we are getting filled in on the national level from Morning Edition. We're learning about President Trump and government shutdowns. Stay tuned for those stories. And then we bring you the Phenology Report, sitting in for the California hiking John Latimer. We've got Charlie Mitchell. And then before 8 o'clock, we bring you more student phenology with Charlie. Let us know what you're seeing. You can text us at 218-326-1234. I'm Heidi Holton. Increasing clouds through our day with highs 72 to 79, breezy southeast winds 5 to 15, gusting up to 20. Cloudy overnight with temperatures 55 to 62 and southeast winds up to 25 miles an hour. Mostly sunny for tomorrow, Wednesday. Highs in the upper 70s to low 80s. And by Thursday, sunny with highs 80 to 84 degrees. Support for this program comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.com. We want to thank you so much for helping us raise over $170,000 during the crisis caused by federal cuts to all of public media. KEXE is working hard to keep the programming you love going strong, to find new funding sources. Every action helps, and every person who donates helps to find funding sources somewhere else. You can donate or share our work. If you haven't yet had a chance to donate, text the word donate right now to 218-326-1234. Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Amy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. The federal government is heading to a shutdown at midnight tonight. If that happens, tens of thousands of government employees will be told they have to stay home. Others will be expected to work without pay. Congressional leaders met at the White House with President Trump yesterday. When it was over, Vice President J.D. Vance came out and said this.
I think we're headed into a shutdown because the Democrats won't do the right thing. I hope they change their mind, but we're going to see. I'll let the speakers.
The last government shutdown was in 2018. Trump was in office then, too. Republicans controlled the House and Senate and needed Democratic votes to pass a spending bill just like now. But as NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith reports, a lot has changed.
Back then, it was Trump who was trying to use a shutdown as leverage to extract a policy win. Billions of dollars in funding to build a border wall, as he told Democratic leaders days before the shutdown.
I am proud to shut down the government for border security, Chuck, because the people of this country don't want criminals and people that have lots of problems and drugs pouring into our country. So I will take the mantle. I will be the one to shut it down. I'm not going to blame you for it.
And shut it down he did, rejecting a last-minute bipartisan compromise to keep the lights on. Once it started, it was really hard to end it.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. The partial federal government shutdown is now 22 days old, making it the longest in U.S. history.
It ended up lasting 35 days. The first Trump administration worked to minimize the impact on Americans, going so far as to keep national parks open, despite many park employees being on forced furlough. Shalonda Young was a top Democratic congressional aide at the time.
They didn't want the shutdown to feel like it had an impact on Americans.
This time, though, the roles are reversed. Democrats are the ones trying to leverage their votes for policy changes. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries spoke outside of the White House last night.
Democrats are fighting to protect the health care of the American people. And we are not going to support a partisan Republican spending bill that continues to gut the health care of everyday Americans. Period. Full stop.
Now it's Republicans accusing Democrats of holding the government, quote, hostage. But there's an escalation from typical temporary furloughs. The White House has instructed agencies to plan for mass firings of federal workers during the potential shutdown. And a new memo says one of the few allowable uses of government-issued equipment during the shutdown for furloughed workers will be checking to see if they've been fired. Young, who was budget director for President Biden, says these threats are unprecedented and just confirm why Democrats don't trust the Trump administration to keep any deal they make.
It feels just different in so many ways. You know, all you have in this town is your word, and it's been broken over and over and over.
The Trump administration's current shutdown posture reflects confidence, says Hogan Gidley, who was a top White House aide in the first Trump term and is now advising House Speaker Mike Johnson. He says the president and Republicans are confident voters are going to blame Democrats for the shutdown.
They're going to shut down the government so that a select few people inside their radical base are happy that they are just standing up and fighting, but they're not getting anything done for the American people.
One person who's had very little to say about this so far is President Trump himself. In 2018, he made sure cameras were rolling for his Oval Office blow-up with Democratic leaders. Yesterday, the cameras were kept out. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
For more on the choices congressional leaders face now, let's go to Alex Conant. He's a Republican strategist and a partner at Firehouse Strategy. So, Alex, as of this morning, neither party is backing down. Do you expect anyone to blink by midnight?
It's possible, but I think unlikely. I think your audience and everyone should be very clear on what is actually happening here, which is earlier this year, the Senate Democrats were faced with a similar choice. Do we keep the government open using Biden-era levels of funding with a CR, or do we shut it down? And at that time, Chuck Schumer thought the move was obvious. Why would we shut down the government and get blamed for that? Let's keep it going, especially since these are Biden-era levels of funding. he got skewered by progressives for doing that to the point where he had to cancel his book tour, you may recall. And so fast forward to today, where the government is about to run out of money tonight. Schumer cannot cave or be seen as caving or giving in to Republicans, or he is, I think, at serious risk of losing his job to progressives. And so he is taking this stance that they're going to draw some sort of concessions from the White House. The White House has no reason to concede anything, especially a major policy reform, like either undoing some of the healthcare changes that were in Trump's signature tax cuts, or by the Obamacare tax extenders, which is a significant and expensive policy change. The Republicans have no reason to cave right now. They want to keep funding the government at least for a couple more weeks. Yeah. And then I think that they will be open to beginning negotiations on some of those other issues as part of a larger funding deal, but they have no interest in caving. I think the only way the government doesn't shut down tonight is if some moderate Senate Democrats cave and they say, look, we don't want to shut down the government. We don't want to get blamed for this. We're happy to keep going at Biden era funding levels.
You know, Alex, I hate to sound cynical with this, but do you think sometimes either political party wants a shutdown to happen just to prove a point?
Certainly the base. Look, I worked in the Senate in 2013 when Republicans there, led by Ted Cruz, shut down the government for quite a while, trying to seek some sort of Obamacare changes. And there were certainly members of the Republican Senate at the time that were happy to see the government shut down, happy to try to force a point. They were richly rewarded by their own base for doing it. Of course, that shutdown failed for Republicans as well. Obama had no reason to concede anything to Ted Cruz and more conservative members of the Senate. And ultimately, moderate Senate Republicans caved, and we reopened the government. I think a similar scenario is likely to play out here. Ironically, also over healthcare funding.
So if, say, Democrats don't get what they want, how do you expect Republicans will respond when their constituents face higher insurance costs?
Well, I think that's a very good question, and one that I think Republicans are open to addressing. I think you do see moderate Senate Republicans, moderate House Republicans. They certainly don't want to raise the cost of health care going into an election year. And so I think that they are open to some sort of extensions for some of these tax credits that are set to expire at the end of the year. They're just not going to do it with a gun pointed to their head. They want to do it as part of some sort of longer term negotiation, not because the government is about to shut down tonight.
Do you think the White House will follow through on its vow to fire people if the shutdown occurs?
I think it's going to try. I mean, this White House has shown zero reluctance to fire federal employees whenever they can, and I think if they can use the shutdown to do that and potentially, you know, make some political pain for Democrats as part of the process, I think they're going to try. Now, whether the courts and others will let them do it, I think remains to be seen.
If the shutdown happens, which party gets the most blame?
Well, I don't think anybody likes a shutdown. I think in the beginning, you'll see both the Democratic base and the Republican base rally behind their leaders. I think the longer this goes on, the harder it becomes for Democrats to explain why they won't reopen the government at Biden-era funding levels. When Republicans are going to be offering to negotiate these things in the coming weeks as part of a larger funding deal.
And really quick, I mean, how does either party in Congress negotiate when a president really can void their work, considering what the Supreme Court just helped President Trump do last week?
Yeah, I think that's a valid question. Something that becomes that remains a valid question, and something that Democrats are certainly going to push. I would remind them and Republicans that, you know, we have elections. Republicans won't be in the White House forever. Whatever power the Supreme Court is giving Trump right now, a future Democratic president's going to have as well.
Republican strategist Alex Konat is with Firehouse Strategies. Alex, thanks.
Thank you.
People in the U.S. and Canada are remembering survivors of Indian boarding schools today and recalling their struggles by wearing orange shirts. Over more than a century, hundreds of government-funded schools sought to assimilate Indigenous children. The goal, according to one leader of the movement, was to, quote, kill the Indian, save the man. Here's NPR's Caden Mills.
Ramona Charette Klein is from the Turtle Mountain Band of Ojibwe in North Dakota. She was just 7 years old when she was sent to the Indian boarding school in Fort Totten, about 100 miles away from home. The experience traumatized her.
There was physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, academic abuse, intellectual abuse, and neglect.
Now 78, She says she felt incredibly alone as a child.
No one was there to believe in me.
For survivors like Klein, today is a day of healing. It's about honoring their experiences and remembering the kids who never went home. The U.S. Department of Interior identified at least 973 children who died in federal Indian boarding schools, though the department says the real number is likely higher.
Morris used to be a boarding school.
21-year-old Nani Makakuman is a student leader at the University of Minnesota Morris.
It was the Morris Industrial School for Indians.
Now it's a university, and about a third of its students are Native American. Makakuman is Menominee and Winnebago. Both her mother and grandmother are boarding school survivors. She says students are planning to mark the day with a procession that will end at one of the boarding school's original buildings.
I know that sometimes this kind of thing can be somber, but I think it should be a celebration of survival because this was a genocide. We survived.
The horrors experienced in boarding schools have often been kept secret, survivors reluctant to share what happened to them, even with close family. But that's been changing.
The more we talk about it, the more awareness there is, then we wouldn't feel so alone. And it's okay to talk about it. This happened to me. I didn't do anything wrong. I was a child. Talk about it. I'm resilient and brilliant. You liked that, didn't you?
Kaden Mills, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
We've been listening to Morning Edition from National Public Radio here on People Powered KAXE. Good morning. I'm Heidi Holton at 7:21. John Latimer is away, but we've got Charlie Mitchell up next with a phonology report. And before 8 o'clock, we bring you more student phonology with Charlie. Kootaska Community Action in Grand Rapids is collecting gently used kids' Halloween costumes now until October 15th. The costumes may be dropped off at the former Murphy Elementary building from 9 to 4 on weekdays. Thanks for joining us and for being a part of this broadcast. We love hearing from you. You can text in to 218-326-1234. A question of the week, we want to know about what you remember about the grocery stores when you were young. Were there special ones or small town ones? We've been getting some great stories from folks, including Gail, who was telling us about the S&H green stamp machines that were spitting out the long strips of stamps and then the prizes they'd get after they collected enough. We heard from our friend Leanne Plinsky this morning as well to 218-326-1234. Leanne says chicken fat mushrooms in Fritz Loven Park in the Brainerd Lakes area. She's got a beautiful photo. Holy cow, every single detail of these mushrooms that she ran into, the chicken fat mushrooms. So let us know what you are seeing. You can text us at 218-326-1234. It's going to be another lovely day on the September 30th. Increasing clouds with highs 72 to 79. Breezy southeast winds 5 to 15, gusting up to 20. Cloudy overnight with temperatures 55 to 62, and we'll see sun again tomorrow. Highs in the upper 70s to low 80s, evening lows near 60. By Thursday, summery day of sunny skies with highs 80 to 84 degrees. We received support this morning from Hot Tubs of Northern Minnesota on Middle School Avenue in Bemidji. They offer hot tubs, pool tables, saunas, and more. Learn more online at hottubsmn.com. We also receive support from Dragonfly Coffee in Central Square Mall in Grand Rapids. They feature a scratch bakery and offer espresso, bubble tea, and more, empowering inclusion and community through employment. Special orders are available and more at drinkdragonfly.com. Coming up at 9 o'clock this morning, we bring you Headwaters. Today, your host is Malachi Coons.
It's time for the Phonology Show. Phonology is the rhythmic biological nature of events as they relate to climate. And I'm Charlie. I'm standing in for John today. Although, you know, my voice isn't quite as low and melodious as John's might be, I'll do my best to clue you in on what's going on out there. The first thing I wanted to talk about was this wonderful online site called Birdcast. And it will tell you exactly what birds are moving through overnight every night. It uses weather radar to count the height and direction of birds flying through. And for instance, on Sunday, the 28th, in Itasca County, it counted 19,900 birds that flew through between 7 p.m. and 7 a.m. The top five that were moving through are the yellow-rumped warblers. You might remember those from spring. They're also called butterbutts. They've got this little yellow patch on their rump, and they're always a welcome sight in spring. And right now, they are moving south. The white-throated sparrow, which sings, "Oh, Canada, Canada, Canada." We have the ring-necked duck flying south. Golden-crowned kinglets, which are tiny, adorable birds that like to move in flocks. They're always kind of on the move. They don't really sit still very long, and they're very small. Think between like a hummingbird and a chickadee. So quite small birds, very cute. It's hard to see their little golden crown unless they're, you know, yelling at another bird and putting the little crown up. But they are one of my favorites. And then American redstarts are also moving south. So we're about halfway through migration season. And again, that website, if you want to look at it, is Birdcast. Other things moving in the bird world right now are the dark-eyed juncos, and they are moving into our region for the winter. They often come right before snow falls, and so we heard a number of our schools seeing dark-eyed juncos over the last week. The way that I always spot them, they like to move in flocks, so you'll rarely only see one at a time. And then right on the outside of the tail, there are these two white feathers that are kind of distinctive as they fly along. So look for the dark-eyed juncos. And then I've also been seeing a lot of turkey vultures and eagles as I drive around. You know, they're both these big brown birds, both kind of heading south. The bald eagles will stick around a little bit longer. The amount of roadkill on the roads helps the bald eagles stay up here later. And then if there's open water, they'll stick around and go fishing as well. But the way I tell these two apart, turkey vultures, also known as watching TV, if you're watching a turkey vulture, turkey vultures hold their wings kind of above their body in a V shape. So think vulture, V. And then they kind of teeter back and forth as they fly. And bald eagles hold their wings even. So I think about eagle and even, vulture, V, to think about how they hold their wings in flight. And then eagles won't tip back and forth in quite the same way that vultures will. So that's kind of an easy way to distinguish two of these large brown soaring birds from each other. Other things I've noticed as I've been driving along, I'm seeing a lot of snakes and turtles on the move across the roads as they're moving to either find their hibernacula in terms of snakes, are on the move to find wherever they're gonna hang out over the winter where they won't get frozen solid. And then turtles are on the move as well. A lot of the young males are gonna be dispersing to new territories or just finding a good spot again to settle in over the winter. So please keep an eye out for them, and if it is safe to do so, help them cross the road. Frogs are still calling occasionally in the evenings. I've seen a lot of toads on the move, especially on those kind of wet, rainy evenings. A lot of toads crossing the road, and they are, you know, getting ready to bury themselves down underneath the frost line and ride out the winter. If you're near water, I recommend keeping an eye on any logs just to see if there are any turtles out basking, particularly on warm mornings. The difficult thing about fall is that it's hard, you know, for a phenologist, is that it's hard to count, to know the last sighting of something until you haven't seen it for a while. In the spring, we have it easy. The first time we see a turtle, we know it's the first time we've seen a turtle. In the fall, you never know which sighting is your last until a couple weeks have gone by. And so, as John would say, it always helps to write it down. And whether that's actually writing it down in a physical notebook or taking a voice memo on your phone, just helps to have a record, and then you know when that last turtle was out basking. In terms of leaf colors, Now, I live down near Stillwater, Minnesota, so about 45 minutes north of the Twin Cities. So my trees are doing something very different from what's going on up in Grand Rapids. But on my side, the oaks are just beginning to change color. Generally, the oaks tend to turn red, bronze, tan, golden. They're just beginning to change color. I'm noticing a couple of them dropping their leaves. Now, white oaks and red oaks are kind of the two big groups of oaks that we have in Minnesota. There are individual species within each of those, but red oaks and white oaks are the two major groups. The way to tell them apart is if you look at the leaf, on a red oak leaf, it's going to end in a little point. So if you think about it, like a little point, like as if you prick your finger, it might draw blood, and that is a red oak, red blood, pointy leaf. A white oak, the ends of those leaves are going to be rounded. There's nothing pointy to them. And red oaks tend to hold on to their leaves throughout winter. White oaks tend to drop all their leaves. That's a tendency. There is variation from tree to tree, but that's the general rule. The maple trees in my area are mostly, unfortunately, turning kind of brown. There hasn't been a lot of good color yet, but the leaves are definitely falling. Along my driveway, I would say over half the trees are bare of the maple trees, mostly sugar maples. And the basswoods are also dropping a lot of their leaves. But of course, the old buckthorn and honeysuckle are still, have all of their leaves and will well into October. So always a good idea to keep an eye out for those. And looking forward into October, some of the things we've got to look forward to around the 1st of October, so this week, the last of the black-eyed Susans will be ending their flowering period. Same thing down here in the city's area. We'll be seeing the last of the purple coneflowers. The red raspberries will begin to change into a very vibrant red color. So keep an eye out for those raspberry leaves to be changing color here soon. October 6th is John's average for first leaf fall for the red maple. And then October 10th is the average for the tamarack, with all of the needles being colored on the tamarack trees. Tamaracks, again, are those odd conifer trees that are also deciduous. They drop all of their needles every fall. Last I heard from the Grand Rapids schools, the tamaracks weren't starting to turn color yet, so it seems like we're going to have a little bit of a later fall than usual, which makes sense given how warm everything has been over the last month. And then October 14th is the rough average for the last morning cloak butterfly in Hubbard County, and those morning cloak butterflies are the same ones that we see in spring. So they overwinter as adults. These ones we're seeing flapping around out here in October are the same friends we'll see in the spring. The last thing I wanted to note before we wrap up here is just the wonderful world of fungi that is out there right now. I know very little about funguses, about mushrooms. I am absolutely a beginner. But beginner or not, if you know how to identify any of them or not, they're just really fun to go out and look at. So I have been, you know, on my hikes and stuff, just trying to keep more of an eye out for fungi. And in my explorations, I found some really cool ones. Do I know what they are? Nope. Do I think they're pretty awesome? Absolutely. So I found one that I lifted up a log because I was looking for a salamander. Didn't find one. What I did find was a empty acorn husk. And inside, just this tiny little acorn husk, were about 8 of these minute little white mushrooms growing, just happily growing inside of this acorn. And it was a lovely little, fairy experience. Just seeing those tiny, tiny mushrooms in an acorn. And then another kind of otherworldly mushroom that I found, so I was looking kind of close to a bog, this kind of wet area, and on this extremely ordinary, run-of-the-mill brown mushroom, this mushroom was sprouting what I can only describe as whiskers. It almost looked like a werewolf mushroom where it had fur. And at the tip of each of these hairs was just a little gland, like something wet, a little droplet. I have no idea what it was. I took a picture, I went home, and started, you know, Googling away mushrooms with hair. And what I found is that there's a group of molds called pin molds. And within this group, there's another subgroup called the Spinellus species or genus. And they are essentially parasites on mushrooms that, yeah, have this really unique look. And so they'll find a good mushroom and grow these little pin hairs, and that's how they spread their spores and go to new mushrooms. But yeah, a mold on a mushroom, who knew? And there, of course, there are these absolutely gorgeous specimens of mushrooms. I've found these orange ones with little black eyelashes. I've found purple ones, just pure white ones. The Amanita mushrooms, which look, if you think about like the Mario mushrooms, the white ones with a red cap with little white dots on it. Those are Amanita mushrooms. Those are beautiful, but absolutely not edible. Don't even try it. They are not good for you. And what I haven't seen yet this year are those big white puffball mushrooms, those gigantic white ones that are like the size of a soccer ball. I haven't seen those yet this year. I think maybe they pop up later in October, but I'm keeping an eye out for those. And yeah, if you've got some time this week, absolutely would recommend getting out and looking for some mushrooms. That's the Phenology Show for this week, and get out there, have some fun.
That is our Phenology Report for this week with Charlie Mitchell sitting in. Charlie's going to be joining us in about 5-6 minutes to bring us some more student reports on nature from around the state of Minnesota. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks for being with us today. We are expecting a day of highs from 72 to 79 with breezy southeast winds 5 to 15, gusting up to 20. Tonight, cloudy with temperatures 55 to 62 degrees. We receive support this morning from Oak Hill Assisted Living in Grand Rapids. They provide personalized care in a home setting. More information at oakhillseniors.com. And thanks also goes out to the Judy Garland Museum, located on Highway 169 in Grand Rapids. They feature Judy Garland's 1920s childhood home and a gallery of Judy and Wizard of Oz memorabilia, including the original carriage from the film. Visitor information is available at judygarlandmuseum.com. We've been asking for you to be a part of the broadcast, as we always do on People Powered Radio, and folks are weighing in on our question of the week. The question this week was about, what do you remember about the grocery stores of your youth? And so many people have stories. We heard from Siri, who said when she was very young, there was a small grocery store in Marcel. I remember slanted wooden floors, glass cases, racks of trinkets, and eating orange push pops on the store's porch. It was magical. I bet she even remembers the sound of walking on those floors. We also heard from Kyle in Grand Rapids. He said the Piggly Wiggly was where they gave you a plastic license plate type thing that matched your tub of groceries that they would send outside on a conveyor belt for you to drive up, and they would load those groceries into your car. Funny how that all went away, and now it's back to curbside pickup. Good to hear from you this morning. Kyle, fun to hear about that kind of stuff. He said that the Piggly Wiggly used to be across from Fuji in that business center there. So you can always text in to us as well, 218-326-1234. Tornado Bob's coming up after 8 o'clock to be talking big weather picture. Right now it's time for Best Wishes, where we do our best to wish our friends and neighbors happy birthday and happy anniversary. So today is September 30th. Lisa and Keith Katsanis celebrate their anniversary. They're from Edina. Mark Statham, happy 69th to you from Brainerd. Robin Rayburn is 72 from Grand Rapids. Happy birthday, Tanya Prim. Tanya turns 51 today from Bemidji. Joe Johnson has a birthday today as well from Bemidji, 76. Enzo Squadroni is 11 years old today. Enzo, hope it is a great day and you get a chance to see a lot of mushrooms today. Mary Ryla celebrates her birthday from Green Bay, Wisconsin and Pacagama Lake. And a very special shout out this morning to Henry Lick. He is 10 years old, the big two digits today. Happy birthday. There was a time when all I knew was the thought and touch of you. But time pulled us away. And it's been years now anyway. Sometimes these things just fall apart. New music there from Shouse and Vance Joy. The song called Wherever You Are. What a lovely way to start a morning. Happy birthday, happy anniversary to all of you. Coming up, we've got more student phonology and reports to bring you. First, we would like to thank Paul Bunyan Communications, are powered by the GigaZone. They're a broadband cooperative featuring all fiber optic GigaZone internet speeds, up to 10 gig and local customer service. Learn more at paulbunyan.net. We also receive support from Edward Jones financial advisor, Christina Gallas, helping individuals and business owners reach their financial goals. More information at edwardjones.com. Edward Jones, member SIPC. Let's take a look at the current temperatures around our region. Warming up a little bit, we are headed to a day of, let's see, mid to upper 70s right now, 61 in Brainerd, 53 in Hibbing, Park Rapids at 59, McGregor reporting 56, Deer River at 57, Bagley reporting 60 degrees, 59 in Park Rapids, and Bemidji reporting 60 degrees this morning. Sitting in this morning for John Latimer, it is Charlie Mitchell, our phonology coordinator, back to talk more student phonology. Charlie, thanks for being here again.
Thank you. Good morning again, Heidi.
Good morning. We want to remind folks that our student phonology is provided in part by the Minnesota Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund.
Yes, they are. Thank you to them. Our next report for the morning comes from Bram Elementary School's trip to Long Lake Conservation Center near Palisade.
Hi, this is Connor,
Adeline,
and Mads from Bram Elementary School with the phonology report from Long Lake Conservation Center. During our trip on September 25th and 26th, the low temp has been 40 degrees Fahrenheit and the high was a sunny 80. White-breasted nuthatches, red-breasted nuthatches, and chickadees were busy taking turns at one of the sunflower seed bird feeders. The other feeder was full of squirrels. There seemed to be an argument worked out between the birds and squirrels. Small flocks of joncos and goldfinches were spotted on the treetops.
Chipmunks and red squirrels were running everywhere, their cheeks full of food. We noticed many leopards and wood frogs when walking on the trails. Several gardener snakes were out and about the forest, and the first one was entering the camp, Hibernella. That usually means that cold temperatures are soon to arrive.
Bumblebees were all over the zinnias in the garden. One flower had a katydid and a bumblebee on it. We found a large number of dragonfly larvae in the lake study class, and also adult dragonflies around the lake. The night skies were clear, and we were able to see the North Star Cassiopeia and the Milky Way. We had a great time exploring nature, and we wanted to remind everyone to unplug, get outside, and live connected!
Thank you, Connor, Adeline, Mads, great report. I particularly love their note on bumblebees. They were all over the zinnias in the garden. You know, we were talking earlier about how once you start looking at things, you discover how many different species of things there are. And bumblebees is a great example of that. The Minnesota Biological Survey went out and just looked for bumblebees in the state of Minnesota and found 503 species, I think, at the last count, of just bees in Minnesota. And I'm just still floored by that fact. There are that many just bees here.
I'm sure you also loved hearing about the garter snakes.
I do, yes. I love a snake heading to their hibernacula. They're doing the same thing here. Just up the road where I walk my dog, there's clearly some sort of hibernacula where a lot of the garter snakes gather over the winter. And September, October, unfortunately, you see a lot of them smushed on the road. But they're definitely on the move, heading somewhere cozy to hang out for the winter. That also means that, you know, all of the toads are digging down under the frost line to hang out all winter. It's just nice to think about everything kind of bedding down and getting ready for a long rest. I'm jealous.
Yeah. You know, I do want to say that the, I know we've talked about this before, but the Long Lake Conservation Center near Palisade in some way is connected to how you are here with us on KEXE. It's sort of part of your origin story. You were one of these kids, right?
Yeah, absolutely. In fifth or sixth grade, Scandia Elementary, which is the elementary school I went to Long Lake Conservation Center. I got my little, you know, wood cookie with my name on it. I had a sweatshirt that was entirely too large for me, but I wore anyways for years. It's a great place. I was there last year and found my first blue-spotted salamander in the wild. Wow. And there is a picture of me holding it and looking just so, so happy. yeah, it's a wonderful place and I think hugely influential for the kids who get to go there. So thanks, Long Lake. Our next report this morning comes from Chad Kaditz's class at Little Falls Middle School.
This is Emma
and Olivia
reporting from Little Falls Middle School. This is our phenology report for the week of September 28th.
There were swarms of male crane flies fluttering in a small cloud trying to attract a female.
Several mushrooms popped up with the wet weather last week. People found bluets, milk caps, bullet, puffballs, rustler, hen of the woods, and shaggy mates.
We're still seeing butter and eggs and several goldenrods in bloom, and we did identify some snake root that a classmate found.
The fairy wings in our yards are very noticeable as the grass around them fades in color.
Giant water bugs are leaving the ponds by our school and can be spotted near light sources in parking lots and the football field on Friday nights.
Leaf miners are fun to find and try to trace the larvae path from earlier this summer.
There have been groups of flickers and blue jays, and red and white breasted nuthatches have been very active at feeders.
Grass spiders and their funnel webs are all over our yards, and the morning dew makes them very easy to find.
We spotted a pair of painted lady butterflies who are heading south on their annual migration.
Wild cucumber and wild grapes seem to be growing on most trees, shrubs, and fences along our roads.
Similar to last year, we have started seeing lilacs that are reflowering. This is apparently a result of stress to the tree.
Box elder bugs have started to appear on the sides of our homes and garages this week.
That is our report for this week. Until next week, keep exploring, keep discovering, and keep connecting with the great outdoors.
Thank you, Emma and Olivia. Great report. I love the note on all of the mushrooms that they found. Bluets, milk caps, bolete, puffballs, russula, hen of the woods, and shaggy manes. Great names all around. We have one growing near here called the indigo milk cap, and it gets its name because if you break it off, this amazing bright blue ink color comes from wherever the mushroom is bruised. It's just a beautiful little mushroom, and if you don't break it, it's just a white mushroom that looks kind of ordinary, but, man, so many little secrets to find in fungi. And then fairy rings. Do you know about fairy rings?
No, I was actually just going to ask you that. What is a fairy ring?
So those are those mysterious little circles of mushrooms that pop up, you know, that come up in a perfect circle.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And they get the name fairy ring because they look like little places for fairies to dance.
Sure.
Yeah, and they're made because, you know, fungus will start in the center and grow outward. And as all of the food and nutrients in the center are depleted, the fungus will die off and it'll just keep growing outward in a circle. And so you'll see the mushroom, the fruiting bodies pop up in a circle kind of where that living mushroom still is while there's nothing in the center.
Wow.
Yeah. Fairy ring. So useful. And then the lilacs are reflowering. That is, as they said, a result of stress to the tree. I think we've heard from a few people that their lilacs are reflowering this fall.
Yeah, I think people are really, I mean, I know there maybe isn't an answer to this. This isn't the first year I've heard people talking about this, but I think they're worried then that they're not going to bloom at the regular time next year. Mm-hmm. What the heck is going on in the universe that I have lilacs right now? Because you think of it as a springtime thing.
Absolutely. And I think we're all worried about a little bit about what's going on in the universe. The lilacs, at least, there is an explanation for.
Okay.
As soon as they're done flowering in the spring, they create the buds that will produce the next year's flowers. And so those are already set and ready. And when autumn comes and they've already been defoliated by, you know, pests or bad conditions or whatever, some of those buds are already ready to go. And with the cooler temperatures, those buds will flower. which means you'll have fewer flowers in the spring. Those won't form a new flower by spring, but they'll still flower in spring. The plant is probably fine. That part of the universe is fine. We can move on.
You know, it's an interesting thing that you said, because of cooler temperatures when it feels like summer right now, but you're talking about it at nighttime, or it had been cooler before, or, you know, just how, you know, weather and climate and how it affects all the living things around us.
Yep. You know, these fall day lengths are similar to the summer, or to the springtime day lengths. So sometimes it can trick the plant and we get blooming lilacs. And our final report this morning comes from Michelle Martin's class at Prairie Creek Community School in Northfield.
Hi, this is Hank. And this is Wyatt. And we're from Prairie Creek Community School, way down south in Northfield, Minnesota. We've got 2 weeks worth of data for you this week. Last year, we were on our class camp out and we saw a ton of cool things. We saw a long-tailed giant ichneumonid wasps laying eggs in the maple with boreholes. We also saw tons of mushrooms, including giant northern tooth fungus. We drank from a spring where we saw and ate a lot of watercress. Back at school, we've been using Merlin to catch birds. We are at high migration right now. One day, we caught 29 different birds on a recording. Both weeks, we've seen sandhill cranes, turkey vultures, hummingbirds, both male and female, blue jays, waxwings, goldfinches, cardinals, and red-winged blackbirds. We're still seeing monarchs, dragonflies, and, unfortunately, mosquitoes. Merlin caught a dark-eyed junco on September 22nd and 23rd. You might have seen one, but it wasn't confirmed. This week, the box elder bugs and the assassin Asian lady beetles have arrived. We have found two giant Cecropia caterpillars here at school. And we released a monarch butterfly that have been watching since it was fourth instar caterpillar. Emery saw a bat in a store, and it wasn't a Halloween decoration. Natalie reported the fog looks like an ocean. Our director Simon's father-in-law always watches the barns walls and rib, and he reports that they have left for the year. Whoa, there's more, but we've got to go. This has been Prairie Creek. One more step along the phenology journey.
Thank you, Hank. Thank you, Wyatt. Great report. There is something that brings my inner scientist so much joy about, we have 2 weeks of data for you this week, coming from those kids.
I know. Mwah. And assassin Asian lady beetles is the way they put it. I don't know if it was how they were pronouncing Asian, but I loved it. I don't care.
Yep, we'll take it. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
They're sort of assassins. They're out there. They stink. They're around. They're too much, you know.
So. Yep, they're a lot. And they saw ichneumonid wasp, those big ones with a super long ovipositor, looks like a tail. I saw a toad that was clearly most of the way done eating one the other day. So only just out of the corner of its little toad mouth, you could see the ovipositor and the rest of it had stuffed in there.
Oh my God.
It was great. A good meal for a toad. And I love that they've been using Merlin to catch...
Yeah.
Birds.
Yes. I love that because they don't want anyone to think that they are hunting for birds, you know, or that there's anything bad happening to the birds, but they're just finding out. And honestly, there's no better way to feel like a kid than use that Merlin app. And suddenly you're like, what? I heard that. Oh, look, Merlin says this. Oh, you know, and then it has taken me a while, but then I start to be able to hear them myself. And as you had mentioned in the phenology report, hand in hand with that is that bird cast. I love seeing how many birds travel overnight through our region and what we might be seeing. And it's very grounding to hear all this stuff.
It is, yeah. And for folks who haven't used the Merlin app, it's put out by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. It's an app you put on your phone, and you can just hit record. It will listen to the sounds around you, and if there are bird calls, it will tell you which birds are calling and, like, pop up a little species name. And it's, again, the learning curve for this job has been incredibly steep, and Merlin has been a huge help for me just learning to identify birds by ear. Anytime you have a chance, just sit outside for a little while with the app running and notice what birds are around you.
It's
a wonderful thing.
So much better than TikTok.